populated barons, and one whose relatively lightly populated barony needed all of the royal patronage it could get. The fact that Caleb has chosen to circle all the way around into the Chisholm Sea to come at us from the north instead of the south could mean several things, of course, Corus continued. The most likely, though, I'm afraid, is that he stopped off at Carmen en route. Do you really think Derwin would betray you, Your Highness? Anvil Rock asked quietly. Frankly, I don't know, Hector shrugged. Ordinarily, I'd say no, for several reasons. But these aren't exactly ordinary conditions, are they? Much as I hate to admit it, almost everyone has to be looking over his shoulder at the moment, wondering what's going to happen to him if we lose to Caleb. And as Philip has just pointed out, Derwin is Zebediah's brother-in-law. We've had no indications that Sir Ferroc might even be contemplating anything of the sort, Corus said. What I'm afraid of is that Zebediah's turned his coat. If he has, it would be just like him to send letters along with Caleb urging his brother-in-law to do the same thing.
With all due respect, Your Highness, Tartarian said, entering the conversation for the first time. I know Baron Derwin. I don't believe he'll be that easily swayed into betraying his loyalty to you.
I think you're probably right, Hector replied thoughtfully. On the other hand, if Zebediah did send a letter like the one Philip is suggesting, then Caleb may have decided it would be worth trying to get Derwin to come over to his side. Deros is a good, relatively deep-water port right there on Whitesail Bay. It's a bit on the cramped size for a really large fleet, but it's big enough to provide a decent anchorage at a pinch if his fleet's still tied down when the storm season really picks up in the next month or two. And it's only about 200 miles overland from Monshear. Admittedly, the Dark Hills are between Derwin and Monshear, but that works both ways. If they'd be an obstacle for his army moving west against Monshear, they'd also give his own base of operations some protection if we managed to concentrate our own forces against him. But the key point is that he's going to need a port somewhere at this time of year. If there's even a chance that Derwin might give him Deros intact and without a fight, it's probably worth his while to at least give it a try.
And if Derwin doesn't go over to him, Deros isn't anywhere nearly as heavily defended as the ports along the Margot Sound coastline, Tartarian agreed unhappily.
We had to prioritize our forces and the new artillery somehow, Tarrell, Hector waved one hand. You and Rysel were right when you pointed out, as I just did, that the Dark Hills cover Monshear from the east. So it made sense to concentrate on fortifying the southwestern ports instead.
Which could also be another indication Caleb has been in contact with Zebediah, Corus pointed out. Zebediah's had plenty of time to discover where we were concentrating our forces. I expect it's exactly the kind of information he would have been gathering up to offer Caleb as proof of his value.
It could indicate that, Hector acknowledged. By the same token, it's hard to hide new coastal batteries, Philip. Any one of the merchant ships passing through the Sound could have reported the information to Caleb.
And even if that isn't what happened, it probably wouldn't have required a military genius to figure out the way we'd approach the problem, Anvil Rock added.
Exactly, Hector nodded. Then he grimaced. All right, I think all of that was worth thinking about, but now we have to concentrate on what we're going to do if they are headed for Derwin.
I wish we had a better estimate of their total strength, my prince, Tartarian said. The good news is that, thanks to the semaphore, we know they're coming at least a 5-day before something as slow as an invasion fleet can reach Deros. The bad news is that we really don't know how much fighting strength they're bringing with them when they come. I know what Philip's reports have been telling us about the size of their fleet, the hundreds of galleons they've been assembling to send after us with every man in the kingdom embarked as elite marines. But as I've been saying all along, I don't trust our sources at this point.
With good reason, I'm afraid, Corus muttered, and Hector's mouth tightened slightly. It was always difficult, managing spies at distances as great as the one between Monchir and Telesburg. Yet the fiendish effectiveness Carizian security had developed over the past couple of years was still something of a sore point. He'd been forced to accept that it wasn't really Corus's fault, since Narmin and all of Caleb's other enemies appeared to have been experiencing precisely the same sort of difficulties. Despite which, the fact that they were forced to rely upon secondary sources, the kinds of intelligence Corus's agents could pick up by questioning merchant captains, or frequenting taverns in other realm seaports to listen to sailors' gossip, left him feeling off balance and half-blind.
I'm prepared to admit that the Carizians, especially now that Chisholm has thrown in with them, can put together an impressive fleet and find the transports they need to lift a fairly substantial army as far as Coruscant, Tartarian continued. I'll believe he has 200 war galleons and 100,000 men when I actually see them, though. Assuming we're actually facing a merely mortal foe, I don't see how he could have as many as 100 war galleons, and I'd be astounded if he'd been able to find the troop lift for more than 50 to 60,000 men. Not to mention the fact that he's had to raise and train his army virtually from scratch. That's going to limit the total manpower he can actually deploy here in Coruscant just as effectively as his troop lift will. I agree, Anvil Rock said, nodding vigorously. Another thing to consider is that after a voyage as long as the one between here and Caris, or even between here and Chisholm, his cavalry mounts and draft animals are going to need at least a 5 day or two on land before they're going to be ready for any sort of serious campaigning.
Against which he'll have the advantage of offshore mobility, Tartarian pointed out. We still don't have the naval strength to face him, which means he can use his transports as aggressively as he likes. And, frankly, he'll be able to move his troops faster and farther than Rysel and Corin can possibly march our troops overland.
Having said that, though, he's not going to want to try anything too tricky right away, the Admiral continued. He's going to make sure he has a solid foothold here in Coruscant before he does anything else. So, wherever he ends up going ashore, and, like you and Philip, my prince, I think Deros is his most probable immediate objective. He's going to spend at least some time establishing a solid defensive perimeter. The point Rysel just made about the condition of his cavalry mounts and draft dragons is also valid. And I suggest we do what we can to make it worse by ordering every horse, mule, and dragon in the Deros area swept up and moved west, out of easy reach from the coast, before his first marine hits the shore. Let's keep him from impressing any of our animals to make up any deficits. That should slow him down some. In fact, I believe we can probably count on at least another 2 or 3 5 days, even after he reaches Deros, before he starts sending any spearheads off to find a way across the Dark Hills. His best route would be by way of Talba Pass, Anvil Rock put in. Well, his shortest and most direct route, at any rate. And I agree with Terrell. We've got time to get Corin into position to cover Talbor before he can get there. For that matter, assuming Taral's estimate of his troop strength is accurate, we can get Corrin there with almost twice the fighting strength. If we start soon enough, we could actually hit Caleb while he's still east of the Dark Hills. We might even be able to get Corrin into position soon enough to pin him down in Deros. At which point he burns down Deros, re-embarks his troops, and sails off to attack us somewhere else, leaving Corrin and the bulk of our army in his wake, Hector said sourly.
All we can do is the best we can do, my prince, Tartarian said reasonably. If we can concentrate our troops quickly enough to attack before he's firmly established in Deros, there's at least the possibility of driving him into the sea. We may not be able to fight him effectively at sea just now, but if this new army of his suffers a major reverse and heavy casualties, we'll probably get at least another 6 months to a year in which to build up our own strength. But if we're going to have any chance of doing that, we've got to take some chances, uncover ourselves in other places, in order to concentrate the troops we need where we have at least the chance of accomplishing something significant.
Anvil Rock nodded again, his expression sober, and Hector's nostrils flared. They'd been over much of this same ground before, and he knew Tartarian and Anvil Rock were right. Now that the moment was actually upon him, however, he discovered that his intellectual agreement with their arguments was far less comforting than it had been when that moment had lain somewhere in a threatening yet still indeterminate future. All right, he said, and looked at Hallman. Father, if you would, I'd like to use the church's semaphore to begin passing orders to Deros, Baron Derwin, and Sir Corrin. Caleb can move troops and men faster than we can, but at least we can pass messages faster than he can. With the Bishop Executor's permission, I think it's time we put that advantage to work for us.
4. Deros, White Sail Bay, Barony of Derwin, League of Coruscant. Fresh thunder rumbled and crashed, and a fresh wall of dirty white smoke billowed up, shot through with flashes of flame, as the line of Carisian galleons sailed majestically past the floating batteries once more. The rapid, disciplined bellowing of their guns was having its effect. Three of the anchored batteries had already been silenced, reduced to shattered ruin despite their heavy bulwarks. Wooden vessels were extraordinarily difficult to sink using solid shot, mainly because the holes those shot punched were relatively small, and most tended to be above the waterline. It could still be done, however, and one of the big, stoutly constructed rafts was listing steeply, beginning to settle as water poured into it. Another was heavily aflame, and the third had simply been shot through and through. The other four were still in action, although their fire was beginning to falter, and bodies floated in the water around them, where they'd been pushed out of the gun ports to clear space for the surviving gun crews to serve their weapons. From this distance, with the city of Deros and the sparkling waters of White Sail Bay as a backdrop, it could almost have been a magnificent spectacle, a tournament arranged to entertain and enthrall. But only if the spectators hadn't experienced the same things themselves, and Caleb Armok had experienced those things. He knew what happened to the fragile bodies of men when round shot came crashing through heavy timber bulwarks in a cloud of lethal splinters. When the man standing beside you was turned into so much bloody gruel by a 20 or 30 pound round shot. When the screams of the wounded cut even through the deafening thunder of your own guns. When the deck, which had been sanded for traction before action, was splashed and patterned and painted in human blood.
He knew what he was truly seeing, and he stood tight-mouthed as he watched the contest, with his hands tightly folded behind him. He was unarmored, without even a sword at his side, and that was part of the reason his mouth was set in such a harsh line. Unfortunately for what he truly wanted to be doing at this moment, his official advisers and Merlin had had a point. The contest against the city of Deros's defenses could have only one outcome. Gallant as the men behind the guns of those beleaguered rafts might be proving themselves, they couldn't possibly stand off the firepower of Caleb's fleet for very much longer. For that matter, trying to employ the full galleon strength under Caleb's immediate command against them would have been foolish. The ships would only have gotten in one another's way, and the possibility of crippling collisions between friendly units would have been very real under such crowded, smoke-choked conditions. And, as Merlin had remorselessly pointed out, if it wasn't practical to use all of his galleons anyway, then there was no possible excuse for using Empress of Caris. It wasn't as if Caleb had anything to prove about his personal courage in order to motivate the men under his command. And sharing the risk when there was no pressing military necessity for him to do so, and when he and Charlian had yet to beget an heir, would have been not simply unnecessary but criminally reckless. One unlucky round shot could have catastrophic consequences, not simply for Caleb, but for all the people he was obligated and pledged to defend. The obligation argument, in Caleb's opinion, had been a particularly low blow, even for Merlin. Nonetheless, he'd been forced to concede the point. And so he'd been standing at Empress of Caris' quarterdeck rail, watching from safely outside artillery range for the last 3 hours as other ships took the brunt of combat. It hadn't been entirely one-sided. As Caleb and his senior commanders had estimated, in no small part on the basis of Sajin Merlin's visions, Hector of Coruscant had indeed gotten the new style artillery into production. He still had nowhere near as many of the new guns as he undoubtedly would have wished, but he obviously did have his equivalent of Edward Hausmann. In addition to all of the brand new guns which had been emerging from his foundries, some infernally clever Coruscantian busybody had figured out how to weld trunnions onto existing cannon, just as Hausmann had done. He'd apparently been busily doing just that for months, too, which helped to explain why two of Caleb's galleons had been forced out of the battle line to make repairs, and why the ships engaging those floating batteries had already suffered upward of 200 casualties of their own. "Why can't those idiots recognize the inevitable and strike their colors before any more people get killed, on either side?" he half growled and half snarled. "Probably because they know their duty when they see it, Your Majesty," Merlin said quietly. Caleb's jaw muscles tightened, and his brown eyes flashed angrily at the infinitely respectful note of reproval in his chief bodyguard's tone. But then the Emperor's nostrils flared as he inhaled a deep breath, and he nodded. "You're right," he acknowledged. It wasn't exactly an apology, but then it hadn't exactly been a rebuke either. He turned his head to give Merlin a crooked smile. "I just hate seeing so many men killed and wounded when it's not going to change anything in the end." "In the ultimate sense, you're probably right about that," Merlin agreed. "On the other hand, they might get lucky. A shot in exactly the wrong place, a spark in a magazine, a smashed lantern somewhere below decks. As Earl Grey Harbor is fond of pointing out, the first rule of battle is that what can go wrong will go wrong." And as your father once pointed out to him, that's true for both sides.
I know, but the fact that you're right doesn't make me like it any better.
Good. The Emperor's eyebrows arched at Merlin's reply, and the sapphire-eyed guardsman smiled a bit sadly at him. An awful lot of people are going to get killed before this is all over, Caleb. I know it's going to be harder on you, but I hope you'll forgive me if I say that the longer it takes for you to begin taking that for granted, the better man and emperor you'll be.
On Caleb's other side, Prince Narman's eyes narrowed thoughtfully as he watched the emperor nod in grave agreement with the Sajan's observation. It wasn't that Narman disagreed with Merlin's observation. If the truth be told, Narman himself was perfectly capable of utter ruthlessness, when necessity required. But he wasn't naturally bloodthirsty. In fact, his ruthlessness was almost a reaction against the sort of bloodthirstiness some rulers, Hector of Coruscant came to mind, often displayed. He'd always had a tendency to focus his ruthlessness on narrowly defined targets, key individuals whose surgical elimination would most advance his plans. And wholesale mayhem offended him. It was messy. Worse, it was sloppy, because it usually indicated he'd failed to properly identify the critical individual or individuals whose removal was truly necessary. Which, among other things, meant he'd probably killed more people in the end than he'd had to. It was also the reason why, even though he would infinitely prefer an emperor who was a bit more ruthless than he had to be, to an emperor who wasn't sufficiently ruthless, he had no quarrel with the Sajan's statement. There were other reasons as well, though, and some of them had been rather unexpected. To his surprise, Narman had actually come to like Caleb. He was a thoroughly decent young man, which was rare enough outside the ranks of heads of state, and Narman would prefer to keep him that way as long as possible, particularly since Caleb was also going to be the brother-in-law of Narman's daughter. But setting that personal consideration completely aside, the last thing Safehold needed was for the young man who had been regretfully prepared to sink the Earl of Thirsk's entire fleet if his surrender terms had been rejected, to turn into a young man who wouldn't have regretted it at all. Yet, however much Narman might approve of Merlin's statement, it wasn't the sort of thing one's bodyguards normally said to one, especially not when one was an emperor. Narman had been prepared for a close relationship between Caleb and the Sajan. That kind of bond between an aristocrat and his most loyal and trusted servants was only to be expected. And Merlin had saved not only Caleb's life, but also those of Archbishop Michael and the Earl of Grey Harbor, not to mention the Sajan's superhuman, already legendary effort to save King Harald's life at Darkos Sound. What wasn't to be expected was for that servant to be almost a mentor to an emperor. Mentor wasn't exactly the right word, as Narman was well aware, but it came close. Caleb listened to Merlin, and he treasured the Sajan's views and opinions on an enormous range of decisions. Of course, unlike altogether too many rulers, Caleb had the incredibly valuable and unfortunately rare ability to listen to his advisers. No one would ever mistake him for an indecisive man, but his very decisiveness gave him the confidence to seek the opinions of others whose judgment he trusted before he reached a decision. Still, there was something different about the way he listened to Merlin's opinions.
"Don't do it, Narman," the prince told himself. "That curiosity of yours is going to get you straight back into trouble yet, if you're not careful."
If Caleb wanted you to know why he respects Sage and Merlin's advice as much as he does, no doubt he'd already have told you. And no, you don't need to be wondering how much the Sagin has to do with all of those remarkable intelligence sources Wave Thunder was very carefully not telling you about. He snorted in quiet amusement at the direction of his own thoughts. Then his head snapped up as a thunderous explosion rolled across the smoke-layered waters of Whitesail Bay. One of the floating batteries still in action against the Carizian galleons had just disappeared in an enormous fireball, and flaming fragments traced lines of smoke across the sky as they arced outward.
"A spark in a magazine, I believe you said, Merlin," Caleb said harshly.
"Probably," Merlin agreed sadly. "On the other hand, they still haven't figured out how to produce corned powder. Even with bagged charges, the way their gunpowder tends to separate and throw out dust clouds is dangerous enough under any circumstances. Given what it has to be like aboard those batteries by this time..."
He shook his head, and Caleb nodded in agreement. Then he looked over his shoulder at Empress of Karis's captain.
"Make a signal, Andre. Instruct Admiral Niles to temporarily disengage. That's better than half their batteries gone, and even the ones still in action have to be in bad shape. Let's give them a chance to think about the advantages of surrender before we kill any more of them."
"Of course, Your Majesty,"
Captain Gerard said, and bowed to his monarch. Gerard had been promoted to his present post after being wounded in action while serving as first lieutenant aboard Caleb's last flagship. He, too, had only too good an idea of what it must be like aboard those shattered batteries, and his expression made it obvious he agreed wholeheartedly with Caleb's decision as he nodded to his signal officer, who'd been standing by, waiting for instructions.
"You heard His Majesty. Make the signal to disengage."
"Aye, aye, sir."
The lieutenant touched his shoulder in salute, then began issuing orders of his own. As the signal flags started to climb the halyards, Caleb turned back to the still-rising column of smoke, where the battery had exploded, and grimaced.
"I could wish we'd been wrong about Hector's ingenuity," he said. "If he's managed to cobble up something like this to defend Deros, what has he come up with for one of his major ports?"
"Probably more than we'd care to tangle with unless we absolutely have to," Merlin replied.
"At least his logistics problems have to be more complex than ours, if only because of his ammunition problems, Your Majesty,"
Captain Gerard pointed out, and Caleb grunted in agreement. The Royal Carizian Navy had standardized the armament of its galleons long before it had become the Imperial Carizian Navy. Ships like Empress of Karis carried the newest artillery, which was actually a bit lighter than the guns Caleb had taken to Armageddon Reef and Darkos Sound. Edward Hausman and Baron Seamount had seen no choice before the previous year's campaign but to use the existing Kraken for their standard artillery piece. It had already been the closest thing to a standard heavy gun the Navy had boasted, so there'd been enough of them to give the fleet a useful initial stock once Hausman had figured out how to add trunnions. But although it had been the only practical choice, it hadn't been the one Seamount had really wanted for several reasons. The biggest one was that the standard Kraken, unlike the larger and longer Great Kraken or Royal Kraken, had been intended as a comparatively short-ranged smashing weapon. Even with the new powder, its relatively short barrel length had reduced the velocity and range of its shot, with a corresponding drop in accuracy at longer ranges. In addition, when Hausman had reamed out the bores to standardize them and reduce windage, he'd had to go to a heavier weight of shot than Seamount had wanted. The Baron had experimented with several different shot weights, trying to find the best balance between hitting power
and the speed with which human muscles could load the weapons, especially the sustained speed with which they could be loaded. Those experiments had suggested that reducing shot weight even slightly would help substantially. So he and Hausman had designed somewhat different models and adopted them once they began producing only newly cast weapons. The new model weapons had longer gun tubes, but they also had reduced bores, so they weighed no more than the older guns. The change hadn't made much difference where the upper deck carronades were concerned, but it had given the much longer and heavier main deck guns greater muzzle velocity and striking power, despite the reduction in each shot's weight by almost 8 pounds. The change had its downsides, of course. The most prominent one was that it had introduced at least some ammunition complications, since the older galleons still mounted their original converted Krakens, whose ammunition was not interchangeable with that of the guns mounted aboard the newer vessels. Compared to most navies, however, the Carisian Navy's ammunition arrangements were simplicity itself. Hausman and Seamount had settled on a total of 4 standard long guns. The new model Kraken, with its roughly 30-pound shot, an 18-pounder, a 14-pounder, intended specifically for chase armaments, with an especially tight windage to enhance accuracy, and a 10-pounder for the same role aboard lighter ships. Their carronade stablemates were a 57-pounder, a 30-pounder, and an 18-pounder. That was an enormous improvement over the old model artillery, which had included no fewer than 15 standard long gun calibers. Not to mention the fact that guns of nominally the same bore size frequently hadn't been able to use the same round shot because different foundries' inches had been a different length from one another before King Harald's draconian enforcement of the new official standards of measurement. They'd sought to further simplify things by decreeing that each individual ship must mount the same caliber of carronades and long guns, at least for broadside armament. They were willing to be a bit more flexible where the chase armament was concerned, but the fact that all of the broadside weapons fired identical projectiles made both the gunners' and the pursers' lives ever so much easier, for the moment at least. Personally, Merlin suspected it wasn't going to be long before the neat official establishment began to leak. As more specialized galleon designs evolved, and the differentiated frigate cruiser and ship-of-the-line battleship emerged, topweight considerations and designed combat roles were going to begin dictating a reversion to mixed armaments. The Coruscantians' rush to improvise as many as possible of the new model guns had left them in a far less enviable position, however, with no time to waste working out any sort of standardized table of naval ordnance. Their new guns appeared to come in no more than 1 or 2 calibers, but the conversions with the welded-on trunnions had pressed as many existing guns as possible into service. One of the floating batteries engaged against them in Deros's defense had obviously mounted at least 3, and possibly 4 different calibers, which must have created nightmares for the man responsible for getting the right size and weight of shot to each gun. Which, unfortunately, Caleb reflected, doesn't keep those guns from being damnably effective when the gunners do get the right shot size.
Your Majesty, we've just received a signal from General Cherman.
Gerard's polite voice interrupted Caleb's thoughts, and the Emperor turned to the flag captain.
And what did the General have to say? He asked.
Brigadier Claric has reported by heliograph, Your Majesty. He has his entire brigade ashore, and the second wave of Brigadier Hayman's troops are landing now. Brigadier Claric estimates both brigades will be in their assigned positions within the next 30 to 40 minutes, an hour at the outside, he says.
Good,
Caleb's tight expression lightened slightly. One of the new Carizian innovations had been the introduction of the heliograph, using reflected sunlight to transmit messages in what another world, in another time, would have called Morse code. Another had been the construction of specifically designed landing craft. They came in two sizes, with the larger capable of landing field artillery, or up to 100 men at a time, while the smaller and faster version could land only 40. Although both designs were capable, theoretically at least, of making extended independent passages under sail, the shallow draft and flat bottoms designed to make over-the-beach landings possible also made them less than ideal blue water vessels at the best of times. Sir Dustin Olvier had improved things at least a bit by providing them with retractable lee boards, but the smaller ones, almost half the total, had made the voyage from Caris as deck cargo, and the captains responsible for getting them to Coruscant had not been delighted by their assignment. At the moment, Caleb's sympathy for their unhappiness was limited, to say the least. The deck cargo landing craft had been swayed out the day before to join their bigger, rather more weather-worn sisters who'd made the passage the hard way. And while Deros's defenders' attention was glued to the galleons, systematically reducing the harbor's seaward defenses to wreckage, Clarake and Haman had busied themselves putting their two marine brigades ashore just out of sight of the town's fortifications. They had only four batteries of field guns and no siege artillery at all to support them. But 4,000 rifle-armed marines wouldn't need a lot of artillery support.
"Someone ask Father Clifford to join us. I think it's time to send another note ashore."
The Emperor showed his teeth in a tight smile.
"I realize Baron Derwin wasn't especially impressed by his brother-in-law's letters. Frankly, I wouldn't have been impressed by anything from Grand Duke Zebediah either. But the beating his batteries have taken ought to be enough to incline him to see reason even without having Clarake and Haman ashore behind him."
"It seems likely, at any rate, Your Majesty," Captain Gerard agreed.
"It better," Caleb said in a harder, somehow darker voice. "If we have to storm his town, it's going to get ugly. I realize our men are better disciplined than most, but even Sidamarkian pikemen's discipline can slip if they take heavy casualties. Especially if they take them storming a position everyone on both sides knows couldn't hold out against them in the end. Besides, even if our people behave themselves perfectly, there are civilians, lots of them, including women and children in Deros."
"Were you thinking of making that point to the Baron in your note, Your Majesty?"
Merlin asked, and Caleb barked a laugh at his bodyguard's painstakingly neutral tone.
"As a matter of fact, yes, but tactfully, Merlin, tactfully. I wasn't thinking of handling this the same way I handled Earl Thirsk, if that's the point you were delicately raising. Observe."
Father Clifford had arrived, portable writing desk in hand, while Caleb was speaking. The Emperor watched his secretary setting up the desk and pulling out a pad of notepaper. The brisk breeze blowing across the deck caught at the edges of the pad's sheets, ruffling them exuberantly, and Caleb quirked an eyebrow at Layman as the priest grabbed the pad, set it on the desk, and jabbed a pair of pushpins through the bottom corners of the top sheet to tame its gyrations.
"Would it be easier on you if we went below, Clifford?" the Emperor asked then with grave courtesy and careful timing.
"No, thank you, Your Majesty." Layman's deadpan expression would have done credit to any trained stage actor, and he shook his head courteously. "By the strangest turn of fate, I appear to have just this instant finished tacking down the notepaper. A peculiar coincidence of timing, I'm certain."
"Goodness," Caleb said demurely. "That is astonishing, isn't it?"
A sniff, barely audible over the sound of wind humming through Empress of Caris's rigging, might have escaped from Layman. Then again, it might have been only the onlooker's imagination. "Truly," Caleb said, his expression much more serious. "Are you ready, Clifford?" "Of course, Your Majesty," Layman replied, his tone equally serious, and dipped his pen in the desk's inkwell.
"Make sure it's properly addressed," Caleb told him. "Use some of that correspondence of Zebediah's to be sure we get the details straight. And I'll rely on you to choose a properly polite salutation."
"Yes, Your Majesty."
"Very well."
The Emperor cleared his throat, then began.
"My lord, your men have fought with a gallantry and determination which deserves only praise and honor, but their position is now hopeless. Your defensive batteries are destroyed or too badly damaged to effectively defend themselves any longer, and my infantry is now ashore in strength and will shortly be prepared to assault your landward defenses. Men who have shown such bravery in action deserve better than to be killed when their position has become obviously untenable, and Deros is a city, not a fortress citadel. I am confident that neither of us desires to find civilians, especially women and children, caught in battle in the middle of their own town, amid their own homes, churches, and shops. In order to avoid additional and ultimately profitless loss of life, both military and civilian, I once again urge you to surrender your position. I will guarantee civil order, the safety of your civilian population, and the preservation of private property insofar as the exigencies of war allow, and men who have fought as valiantly and steadfastly as your men have this day deserve and will receive honorable and correct treatment under the laws of warfare."
He paused, as if considering adding something else, then shrugged.
"Read that back, please, Clifford."
"Of course, Your Majesty."
The priest read the entire brief message aloud, and Caleb nodded.
"I think that should just about do it. Make a clean copy for my signature, and let's be certain it's properly sealed as well as addressed. I don't want the Baron thinking we dashed it off hastily, now do I?"
"No, Your Majesty."
Layman bowed to the Emperor, and this time he did retire to the shelter of Caleb's day cabin to produce the formal note on Caleb's personal stationery, complete with the properly correct and ornate calligraphy.
"There," Caleb told Merlin. "You see? No crude threats. Just one reasonable man sending a note to another reasonable man."
"Much smoother than your conversation with Thirsk, Your Majesty," Merlin agreed respectfully. "I especially liked the bit at the end when you didn't say, 'or else.'"
"Yes, I thought that was well done myself," Caleb said with a smile.
5. The Laughing Bride Tavern, City of Talisburg, Kingdom of Caris. The man who stepped through the Laughing Bride's front door was plainly dressed. The hot, humid March night was blacker than the inside of a boot, but thunder rumbled out over Howell Bay, and occasionally flashes of lightning lit the banks of heavy cloud, rolling steadily in across the city of Telesburg. Even though no rain had fallen yet, the fact that the visitor wore a poncho was certainly understandable, despite the temperature, under the circumstances.
"Can I help you?"
the tavern's owner asked as he stepped across to personally greet the newcomer. It was late, and with the threatening weather, the Laughing Bride was scarcely packed.
"I'm looking for someone," the man in the poncho said. "I was told to ask for Master Darius."
"Ah."
Something might have flickered deep inside the publican's eyes. If so, it disappeared as quickly as it had come, like one of the cloud-buried lightning flashes out over the bay, and he nodded.
"He's taken the private tap room for the evening. Through that arch, he pointed, and down the hallway. Last door on the right.
Thank you. The man in the poncho nodded and headed down the indicated hallway. He paused outside the door of the taproom for just a moment, almost as if he were drawing a deep breath. Then he knocked once, crisply. The door opened quickly, and he found himself facing a youngish man dressed like a moderately successful merchant or shop owner.
Yes, the younger man said courteously. I have a message from Master Darius, the man in the hallway said once more.
If there might have been a flicker of something in the tavern owner's eyes, the brief tightening of the younger man's expression was unmistakable. But he stepped back courteously enough, inviting the other man into the small taproom, then closed the door behind him. There were just under a dozen other men present, and all of them turned their heads, looking at the newcomer with expressions which varied from calmness to obvious uneasiness. In some cases, possibly even fear.
Ah, there you are!
Another voice greeted the new arrival as yet another man, this one considerably older and rather better dressed than the fellow who had opened the door for him, looked up from a quietly intense conversation with one of the others seated around the small tables.
I apologize for my tardiness, Master Darius, the newcomer said. It was a bit difficult to get away without raising any questions.
That wasn't a criticism, the man called Master Darius said reassuringly. I'm just happy and relieved to see you after all.
The man in the poncho bowed slightly, and Master Darius's waving hand invited him over to take a seat.
Seriously, Darius continued as the late arrival obeyed his unspoken invitation. I was beginning to feel a bit anxious. Baron Wave Thunder's agents have proven even more effective than I'd anticipated.
I've noticed the same thing, my lord.
I believe we might stay with simple Master Darius even here, Darius said.
Of course.
The man in the poncho colored very slightly, and Darius chuckled and reached across the table to pat him on the shoulder.
Don't worry about it so much, my son. Old habits die hard, and this isn't exactly something any of us expected to be facing now, is it?
No, it isn't, the other man said feelingly,
and this time two or three of the others snorted or chuckled in harsh agreement.
Unfortunately, we are facing it, Darius continued, and given that we've all just agreed that Wave Thunder's agents appear to be everywhere, we'd all best get into the habits of successful conspirators. Which is why, even though I realize one or two of you already know one another, I think we'll avoid using any names tonight. Agreed?
Everyone nodded, and he smiled thinly.
Very well, my friends. In that case, it's time we were getting down to business. We have much to discuss, much which will come as a surprise to many of you, I suspect. And, as I promised when first we came together, the time to strike draws rapidly closer. Indeed, if tonight's meeting goes as planned, that time is almost upon us.
The others looked back at him in silence, their expressions a blend of excitement, anticipation, determination, and fear, and his smile grew broader and warmer.
Yes, we do indeed have much to discuss and to plan, but first, will you join me in a moment of prayer? Confident you can see why the arrangements near the convent are critical to our success, Master Darius said some hours later. And given the location of your manor, you're definitely the one of us best placed to see to those details. So, if you're willing to shoulder the responsibility and the risk, we'll leave their arrangement in your hands.
The most important thing to remember is that none of the rest of us can play our part until those arrangements are solidly in place. If any problem should arise, or if you should discover that you require additional funds or any other assistance, you must let us know promptly so we can adjust our schedule. Father Terran will know how to contact me at any time, should there be need. It may take some days for any message from him to reach me, but be assured that it will.
Of course, Master Darius, the man to whom he'd been speaking said, and pushed back his chair. He stood, bowed to Darius and the two others who were still present, then left the taproom. Even as he stepped through the doorway, the abrupt torrential rush of a thunderstorm came pounding down on the Laughing Bride's roof. Thunder crashed suddenly almost directly overhead, shaking the tavern about its bones, and Darius shook his head as the door closed behind the departing man.
"I fear Langhorne is providing an appropriate backdrop for this evening's meeting," he said.
"In more ways than one," the man who'd arrived late agreed dourly. "I'm not looking forward to the walk clear back to the palace through this." He twitched his head in the direction of the taproom's shuttered windows, and the man who'd assumed the name of Darius chuckled.
"At least it should mean you're unlikely to meet anyone who might wonder where you've been, Father," he pointed out,
relaxing his own security rules in recognition that all of those remaining already knew one another's identities.
"In fact, that might be the very reason God provided this little shower."
"If he did, I'm sure he knows best, my lord," the priest said. "On the other hand, not every task God sends us is equally enjoyable."
"No," Darius said, his tone and expression both darkening. "No, it isn't."
"My lord, I mean Master Darius," one of the others began, his voice quiet in the rushing water sound of the thunderstorm.
"I think we can be a little less circumspect at this point, Mytron," Bishop Miles Halcombe said.
"Yes, my lord, thank you." The other man smiled briefly, but his obvious unhappiness didn't ease appreciably. "I was just going to ask, is this task really necessary?"
"Unfortunately, I believe the answer is yes," Halcombe said. "It's not the sort of thing I ever thought God would call me to do, and I don't expect it to be easy for any of us. Yet the truth is, my sons, that when Shan Wei works her evil in the world of mortals, sometimes men who stand for the light find themselves called to hard tasks."
The man who'd asked the question nodded, but his expression remained troubled, and Halcombe gave him a gentle, sad smile.
"When Charlian voluntarily joined with Caleb in his attack upon Mother Church, she made herself an enemy of God, Mytron," he said. "I've never actually met her, of course. Everything I've ever heard of her would seem to indicate she's always been a good ruler, with a deep interest in justice and the well-being of her people. But whatever she may have been in the past, she no longer is. It may well be she truly believes what she and Caleb are doing is God's will. If so, however, both of them are wrong. And in many ways, a good and sincere person, mistakenly serving Shan Wei's ends with absolutely no evil intention, is the most deadly threat of all. Those who openly and obviously serve corruption are easily denounced, easily discredited. Those who fall into sin through good but misguided intentions and mistaken understanding often sound reasonable and convincing. They have no evil motives, however evil the ultimate outcome of their actions may be, and people such as that are far more seductive than the open and deliberate enemies of God. That's always true,
but it takes on an even greater significance in Charlian's case, I'm afraid. Just look at how her popularity here in Karis is already working to bolster Caleb and the other schismatic leadership, even in the face of excommunication and interdict.
Heads nodded around the table, and more than one face tightened. The writs of excommunication for Caleb Armach and Michael Stainair, along with the proclamation of the interdiction of the entire Kingdom of Karis, had arrived less than 2 5-days earlier. The shock, however, had been less profound than one might have anticipated, given the severity of the penalties involved, and there was very little sign of any significant reaction against the authority of the crown or of the Archbishop of the Church of Karis. Partly, no doubt, that was because Stainair and Caleb had foreseen the probability of such an action from the very beginning, and had carefully warned their supporters that it might be coming. Another major factor was that the church itself in Karis had blithely ignored the proclamations. Despite the interdict, churches were open and sacraments were administered. When the priesthood scorned the legitimate decrees and proclamations of Mother Church, how could the laity be blamed for following suit? Especially when the very grounds for the schismatics' rejection of Mother Church's authority further undercut the legitimacy of those writs through their scorching condemnation of the corruption of the vicarate which had issued them. But there was another factor as well, Holcomb felt certain. Charlian had not been excommunicated, obviously because no one in Zion had anticipated the possibility of her marriage to Caleb when the writs were originally issued 2 months earlier. The fact that she hadn't been, coupled with the way in which she had taken the heart of Karis by storm, made her a sort of legitimating source of the authority and fealty the church had formerly stripped away from Caleb. At the moment, he continued, Charlian's very reputation as a good and just ruler, the fact that she's so likable, has put a smiling face on Shanwei's corruption. That's bad enough. But she genuinely believes in what she's doing. She hasn't been misled or deceived by Caleb, and her commitment, in my judgment, is every bit as powerful as his own. She isn't going to allow herself to be used as a weapon against something in which she truly believes. That's why I believe our friend in the palace is mistaken.
I'm afraid you're right about that, the priest who'd shed the poncho said heavily. I believe he's sincere, although I'm also inclined to think his motivations aren't quite as selfless as he says. In fact, I think they aren't quite as selfless as he truly believes they are. And, of course, there are all of those other, more personal factors involved in his thinking. But however sincere he may be, he simply doesn't want to face hard, unpleasant facts.
Which ones? The man who'd questioned Darius asked, and the priest raised his hand, counting off points on his fingers as he made them.
First, I don't think he truly wants to admit she's become an enemy of God. He desperately wants to believe she's only temporarily mistaken, that, given time, she'll return to her senses. And second, he doesn't want to admit how deeply and sincerely attached to her the majority of her subjects actually are. I think he underestimates the importance of her support among the common-born folk on this issue, probably because he's not one of them himself. That's more than a little ironic in light of past events, but I suppose it's also possible that he's fooling himself on this point because he doesn't want to face the logical implications. But whatever he may be thinking, or why ever he may be thinking it, the truth is that she's genuinely loved. In fact, his entire plan revolves around using that love for our own ends. And superficially, it's a very attractive concept.
When she not only held the throne after her father's death, but also proved to be one of the strongest rulers in Chisholm's history, she won their hearts as well as their loyalty. Despite how deeply they respect her, the common folk also feel actively possessive about her, almost as if she were a favorite beautiful sister or daughter.